True Crime Texarkana is brought to you by J.E. Bonding, Texarkana, Arkansas's premier bail bond company. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, J.E. Bonding can handle all your bail bond needs. Agent Mark Luckett will provide you with fast, courteous service and do his best to help you through a trying time. Mark has all the experience you need to make the best of a sad situation. That's why he likes to say, two tears in the bucket, call Mark Luckett. Call him at 903-748-1402 or visit J.E. Bonding at 2315 East Street near the Miller County Sheriff's Office and Detention Center. That's 903-748-1402. 1402. Hello, everyone. Carl Richter here with Mallory Wyatt.
Hi.
We decided to skip the normal introduction that we usually start our episodes with and just talk a little bit about what happened last week. In case you missed it, the investigators into the Alexander case announced that the kid's father, Weldon Alexander, was the sole viable suspect and that they're satisfied that the case has been solved. In today's episode, you'll hear a new interview with Captain Calvin Seward and Dr. Todd Steffi, the main investigators in the case. It'll be the most extensive interview they've given since they made that announcement. Were you surprised last week when Weldon's name came out, Mallory?
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting things to go a different direction, but, you know, when you look at all the pieces of evidence and how it all just slides together and it just works, it does truly make sense. So I have to hand it to them that they did not have the easiest job going into this, and I think they found their guy.
Yeah, part of this interview people are about to hear is about how they took various lines of evidence. It's not just DNA to sort of put together the story of what happened. I think that's really interesting. And they talk about how some initial assumptions got in the way and they had to sort of challenge their own.
They had to combat their biases.
Exactly.
Biases.
Yeah, which is interesting, too. We talked a little bit about the murder weapon, the timeline, which I think is very interesting and surprising. It was surprising to me.
For me, that was the clincher of all of it, was the timeline of it all. And actually figuring out when Gordon's actual time of death was.
Right.
Because that's what really kickstarted this new, I guess, line of thinking for them. Mm-hmm.
And there's one shocking detail there that I won't spoil right now, but there's part of that part that's chilling to me. It's just so sad.
Yeah, but hopefully now that we all know who did this, hopefully this means that the kids can rest. Mm-hmm. And hopefully this means that their mom can rest as well now, too.
Yeah, let's just focus on that.
Yeah.
Okay, here's our interview.
All right, so how are y'all doing? How does it feel that y'all have this case closed?
It feels good that we have it solved. It's not officially closed until we get everything together, you know, and all of it. But it feels good to have it solved, and there's a big load off because we've been doing this for like 18 months now, and now we have it resolved, and just hopefully bring some closure to some people.
I feel great. I'm very glad we were able to bring about a good resolution to the case.
The person you ended up with is not someone you, it seems like, not someone you thought of much before. So how did that happen? How did that change happen? Where was there a light bulb that went on that said, must be him?
Let me address that. Dr. Steffi had looked at everything was pointing to the father well before I got on board with it. I'll be totally honest with you. Mm-hmm. And even the crime lab, everything was pointing to it. But the time of death was a big thing that we were dealing with that just didn't fit. And then once we got back and started looking at that and determined that that was wrong, mm-hmm. then everything fell into place. It would have been better if it had been some Booker man like Henry Lee Lucas mm-hmm. or some serial killer or something that did it. But the fact of the matter, it wasn't. And none of the evidence ever indicated that it was any stranger like that who just comes into town and kills someone. But Dr. Steffi can explain to you probably the more the physical evidence about how we determined.
Yeah, could you go into the transition of how y'all went from what y'all are initially thinking, which now that we can talk a little bit more openly, y'all had told me your ideas over the past couple months, like what y'all had thought initially, not who, but what, you know.
Yeah.
But now y'all had this shift about a couple months ago. What spurred that on?
You know, early on, there were things that in just kind of doing a forensic review of the case file, and in which I look over the crime scene and the witness statements and crime lab reports, forensic reports. I look over the evidence that's available, and I start trying to piece things together so that they tell a story. And you know, early on, there were things that to me suggested sort of someone familiar to the kids, someone from inside the home, or certainly with close knowledge of inside the home. There were things that pointed in that direction, and I think a lot of people probably saw that. But you know, in the beginning of my involvement, there was the problem was I was, you know, as Calvin and I were, Captain Seward and I were of the understanding that he had an alibi that was confirmed. And so we're kind of like, oh, OK, well, let's keep looking at the evidence, because you want evidence to guide the path, to guide the way. And one of the things I start to look for in a cold case is I start to try to look for and identify what might be the cognitive bias, or what I call the anchor point. Anchoring is a type of cognitive bias in which you get an initial piece of information. It could be a piece of evidence. It could be a witness statement. But you get an initial piece of information, and you sort of assume that it's true. You start from this point of assumption, this presupposition or a presumption that this is a good starting point. And what ends up happening is as you uncover new pieces of evidence, new pieces of information, subsequent pieces of information, you interpret them in light of your anchor point. When you, as you progress through the case, if you have forensic evidence that are pointing in a direction that is pointing in a direction that disconfirms what you have believed, then you have to go back and re-examine what you believed about that item or that piece of information. And so kind of, I guess, to sort of walk through this case a little bit, when I came on board with Captain Seward in the early part of 2022, TAPD had some pretty good evidence. They had resubmitted evidence to the crime lab in 2012 and had gotten some DNA reports back, some forensic reports back on DNA in 2013. So they got the forensic reports back, and here we now know we have DNA, but having DNA doesn't necessarily tell the story. We don't know, for instance, whose DNA we're looking at. And in this case in particular, one of the difficulties was it occurred prior to the day and time when we did DNA testing. So we didn't have any known standards known samples of the victims to compare with questioned DNA. So in talking with Captain Seward, we needed some kind of a known biological sample from our victims to do this. And the one thing we had were fingernail clippings from both victims. And so we requested that DNA be extracted from the fingernail tissues. Up until then, the focus had been on what DNA may have been present underneath the fingernails. And I suggested we try to have DNA extracted from fingernail tissues as known samples. And I think that was kind of a turning point because then we had some known DNA that we could compare with questioned DNA. And then we could start allowing the DNA to tell the story of what happened. We were better suited to tell whose DNA we're looking at where. And so the thing we consider in letting the DNA tell the story, we want to know things like, what is the biological material that's yielding the DNA? Is it skin cells? Is it blood? Is it saliva? Is it hair? Is it semen? Sometimes that helps tell the story. And then also we consider where the DNA is found. And so eventually the forensic evidence is this decisively to the father that we needed to go back and reconsider his alibi. And I would say in this particular case, the anchor point was probably his alibi and the time of death for Gordon. There had been this assumption that the time of death was somewhere around 5:30 or 6:30 in the morning when he came home at 7:15.
Now, where did that initial time frame come from? How did you begin to think during that time?
Yeah. So time of death, let me just talk about time. Time of death is an estimate. It's not exact. And that is sometimes difficult to exact on. So you can make a scientific estimate. So we look at certain things like body temperature, core body temperature, environmental factors, things like that. And there's a mathematical equation that helps us arrive at a pretty good estimate of time of death. And I'll say this too about time of death. A lot of times in estimating time of death, we sometimes rely heavily on witness statements. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I think that was the case. One of the witness statements that was relied on pretty heavily to estimate the time of death on Gordon was his dad's statement, mm-hmm. that he had had said that he had called and talked to his daughter at midnight or about midnight, and that everything was fine. And he indicated that she had to get out of bed to answer the phone. The phone was a wall-mounted phone back in the day. But, you know, in reexamining the time of death, it was pretty simple for us to, for Captain Seward and myself, to come to the conclusion that the time of death was much more likely several hours prior to what was believed. In fact, when I first came on board, I remember at one point and I brought up the dad, I don't know, Captain Seward, you might remember, I brought up the dad probably two or three times over the course of a year. And at one point I remember being told, well, we know that they were killed sometime after midnight. Well, that's based on his statement that he had spoken with his daughter at midnight.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. So we, you know, when Captain Seward went back at that point, you know, we had a conversation about the forensic evidence that it's pointing in this direction. We need to go back and look at the dad's alibi, and that is anchored to the time of death that was estimated for Gordon. And so we were able to do what I would say is a much more scientific estimation on time of death on him, and it I think conservatively would put the time of death a good 10 or 11 hours prior to the morning of the discovery. So once we determined the time of death was off, we really took a hard look at his alibi and his statements. And one of the things that TAPD investigators did very well on the front end was they locked him into his statement of what he said happened. Now that we have evidence, we can go back and see if his statement is true or if it seems that he is lying. And, you know, in his statement, he had made statements that didn't, even from the beginning, didn't really match the evidence at the scene. It made me call into question his alibi. Things that didn't line up between the crime scene and his statement. Like his statement indicating that when he called home at midnight, they were in bed. Nothing about that crime scene suggests that those kids had ever gone to bed the night before. Mm-hmm. In fact, it suggests the opposite. They never went to bed the night before. And so things like that really stand out. And, you know, I've often said in conducting suspect interviews that one thing that I like as well as, if not better than, a true confession is a lie that I can prove is a lie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can take that to court and you can say, okay, here's what my suspect said. Here's what the evidence proves. And so in this particular case, the alibi pretty quickly fell apart. And we realized that the forensic evidence was really telling us a story that we needed to listen to.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but if that new time estimate is right, there may have been some hours between the time he attacked them and the time he went to work.
In my estimation, I would think conservatively that the children were attacked well before their dad left for work. Certainly within time for him to have been able to clean up and kind of get an idea of what his alibi would be. And it's my belief that he went to work to create an alibi and that the phone call at midnight was fabricated to create an alibi, substantiate an alibi. And that when he got home and, you know, they they even questioned him about not using his home phone to call authorities when he got home. He went to a neighbor, and even the statements that he made there were sort of self-contradicting and inconsistent with other statements he had made. And so it appears that he just created an alibi and then tried to create ways to confirm his alibi.
Was there anything that stood out in Weldon's statements initially? I know that there were some inconsistencies, but was there anything else that stood out that he said?
For me, and Captain Seward may have some too, but for me, it was the statement that the kids, indicating that the kids were in bed. From the beginning, it looked to me like they had not been in bed. That became even more apparent once we had the forensic evidence that pointed to him. And, you know, there were, for example, kids were dressed in their street clothes, not the pajamas. And, you know, Karen was found on top of her bed with the bed still made. There was no indication that the kids had been in bed and were somehow or other surprised by someone coming in the middle of the night. There was nothing that indicated really a surprise attack to me. There was no sign of forced entry. The weapon was a weapon from inside the home. It was what we call a weapon of opportunity. And in this case, I would say a weapon of immediate opportunity. And what I mean by that is, while the perpetrator has Gordon on the floor, you know, in the throes of the attack, whether he's punching or choking, right above Gordon's head, right in the face of the perpetrator, would be this drawer with these utensils. And that is what I would say is a weapon of immediate opportunity. If an outside intruder was going to come into the home and kill these children, I would expect that he would bring a much better weapon than what was used in this case. So there were things like that pointed in a direction, but not, you know, again, with this anchor point, it didn't confirm the anchor point that the dad had the alibi. And honestly, Captain Seward and I looked at the possibility of suspects from outside of the home who would perhaps be familiar with the home or know the kids. We looked at some suspects. We were able to actually rule out. There was one in particular that we were able to rule out with the forensic evidence. And in the end, you know, it kind of comes down to you have this forensic evidence in the form of DNA of the presence of three people, and two of those people are dead. Mm-hmm. And the other one has an alibi that we can now go back and show is a false alibi, and that it appears that he actually statements that were untrue. So that's a pretty solid case. He made several statements that were, in my mind, self-contradicting, and in some cases just not confirmed, but actually disconfirmed by the crime scene itself or by the evidence that we were able to eventually obtain.
Can we go back to the weapon? A lot of people have expressed real shock that it was a butter knife. Can you maybe just describe it in a little bit more detail? Did it have a point?
Yeah. You know, and when we use the word butter knife, we're not exaggerating that. It's literally what you would use to butter bread. Mm-hmm. It's not a sharp knife. It's not a knife that has a sharp point. And so when I say it's a weapon of immediate opportunity, you know, if a perpetrator is in the throes of the act of committing a crime, has somebody down in the floor who maybe is trying to get to the phone to call police, three steps across the kitchen may be a much better choice of knife for a murder weapon.
Is my belief is as they were struggling that he opens the drawer and just reaches in and grabs the first thing he can get, and he picks up the butter knife. That's what he gets, because there's other knives around that he could have picked up. So as he says, that's the weapon of opportunity. He didn't go over and just pick through it. I believe he just reached in the drawer, and that's what he felt, and that's what he come out with to use, because he was losing the struggle. And
is it safe to say that it would have taken a lot more force, a lot more vigorous of an attack with that weapon than it would have with, say, a sharper knife, a steak knife, say?
Course.
Oh yes, I would say so. I think it would take. I think it would be a lot worse. It would make the attack a lot worse for the victim.
Every piece of the puzzle fell into place once we got the father as a suspect. I looked at a lot of other things that I thought would be the way to go. But the fact of the matter is, you have to go with the evidence, and this is where the evidence led us. And you know, it's a terrible thing.
This case is, you know, there is the DNA evidence that is pretty good, but we have DNA evidence, we have trace evidence that pointed in that direction. We have his statement that now appears to be inconsistent with the evidence. So it's really a combination of things. It's not just one thing that points to him. It's a number of things that point to him. You have to put each piece of evidence back in the context of the crime itself. And the context involves the crime scene. It involves the DNA. It involves the father's statement, his alibi. It involves the time of death. It involves evidence. It involves so many things. And you have to interpret each piece of evidence in light of every other piece of evidence and in light of the overall context of the crime itself.
One of those things was that Karen had been sexually assaulted. Am I wrong? Did you never make that public before last week?
I want to think that probably was covered it. Something in it, maybe in a news article about, but I can't swear to that. But
that was something that Captain Seward and I never really made public, I don't guess. I don't know if it was in years past, but there were actually several things that Captain Seward and I didn't make public during our time working together.
I mean, why is that? Is it one of those things that only the killer would know?
Well, I think for me, part of it is, you know, waiting to get all of the pieces of the puzzle and interpreting them within the context of the story. You know, the fact that there's been vaginal penetration by itself doesn't tell the story. But when you connect that to this DNA that's from a biological specimen of semen stain, when you connect that then with the father's alibi that is false, and you connect that with the time of death that was wrong, and you connect that with the forensic, trace evidence analysis, then all those pieces collectively start telling Karen's story.
You never give out all the information in any case you work. I mean, it'd be silly to. Also, things that's in a person's personal life that does not or may not have anything to do with the case, you don't release that because it's really nobody's business. And the more stuff you put out there, it's more things for people to say, well, I don't believe this, I don't believe that. Well, you know, you can believe what you want to believe. Nobody's going to change your mind. But I'm confident the evidence is pointing to the only viable suspect in this thing, and there's plenty of evidence there to indicate that he's the only person responsible, and I don't have any question about whether or not it is, and so that is why I'm resolved. For me, the case is solved. It's over with.
And you know, Mallory, I was asked, you know, how certain am I that we have identified the correct person? And I always go back to this level of legal certainty. I used to, when I was teaching college, I would lecture on this. You know, our system, our justice system, has these levels of legal proof that have to be reached in order for certain things to take place in our justice system. And, you know, you can have reasonable suspicion, which we had a lot of that in this case, and a lot of different people it was reasonable for us to be suspicious of. But eventually you have to reach a level of that constitutes probable cause for an arrest to be made. But even beyond that, you know, two or three steps on further down this spectrum of legal certainty is the level that we refer to as beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's the level that's necessary for a conviction in a criminal case. And, you know, we eventually reached this level that Captain Certain decided this is probably beyond a reasonable doubt now. And that was when we decided to meet with Ms. Mitchell, Connie Mitchell, the prosecuting attorney, and to present the case to her. And because at that point, it really depends on her opinion. And so we presented the case to her as we understand it. And she asked whatever questions she needed to ask for clarification. I think we spent about 3 hours or more presenting the case, answering questions, and left materials with her to review. And she came to the same conclusion that we came to, that the dad is the only viable suspect. And not only did she feel that there was probable cause, but that she felt confident enough that if he had been alive, she said she would pursue charges for two counts of capital murder. And so that puts it at, in her opinion, in our opinion, my opinion, that's a way of us saying we believe this to be beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a pretty strong case. In fact, that is a very strong case for a case that's 42 years old.
We didn't have to take those steps. Once we arrived at looking at the evidence and everything, we said, okay, you know, this is who we believe is responsible. But we wanted to go that extra step so we could be sure. And so that's the reason we did that. And the prosecutor, she looked at it after us. Like you say, we spent probably 3 hours with her. And it was several days before we got her letter back indicating to us that what she would do. So that was just another confirmation of what we felt like was what we already knew.
I'm glad you mentioned that, that, you know, that was an extra step that was not necessary. Some cold cases are closed only at the point of the only known viable suspect being deceased, and they're just closed at that point. I'm glad Captain Seward mentioned that. This was an extra step that we wanted to take, and we felt the case was that strong that that we could take that step.
How do y'all feel about the fact that Weldon never really got justice? He got to go on living for more than 30 years. He had a second family.
I think your statement is not exactly correct. I'm a firm believer that justice does come. And I don't think he has avoided justice. You know, I'm a Christian. I'm a believer. And I believe that there's a day of judgment coming. And I believe all of us will give an account for how we've lived. Calvin, you want to weigh in on that?
Yes, I agree with you on that. But who knows exactly what that man thought. This man did not intend to kill his children. The things that went on, there's things happen and then got out of control. After the morning of, one of the things that more than one person saw, they said he was so calm. You know, they couldn't understand how a man that found his children like that could be so calm. And that really bothered them. And one of the original investigators on this case, it bothered him to the point that he felt like, okay, this guy's responsible for it. But he was not able to follow up or do anything on it. And, of course, again, DNA was not there at that time. Hopefully, Weldon made it right with God before he passed away, and I'm sure that after that was over with, he had to spend a lot of time and had to be a lot of regrets. He had to live with that, but I think there was relief in it. He felt like he got away with it, but you never get away with anything that you do that is wrong. Unless you make it right with God.
And if I could add to that, you know, people want such a horrific crime as this to be the fault of some monster. And unfortunately, a lot of people don't really know that a monster doesn't really look like a monster. They look all too normal oftentimes. And people will often have deep-seated, deep-rooted issues that are hidden in public persona. And, you know, probably their dad had some deep issues of his own that, who knows, maybe things that he experienced growing up created these issues for him. And you know, you never know what a person has been through that made them the monster they are. And like Captain Seward said, maybe he, before he died, maybe he found his way to God and made things right. I don't know, but yeah. I do believe that those kids are in a better place than you and I are in right now.
Yes.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you. You know, you guys have, as reporters, you know, we've talked before about this case, and I just wanted to thank you, the two of you, for being easy to work with. And Mallory, I told you the other day, you know, I listened to your podcast, and that last episode I listened to, you were not really that far off. You might feel like you were, but you were noticing some of the same things I was noticing, that Captain Seward noticed. You know, the fact that there was no forced entry of weapon from inside the home, somebody familiar with to the kids. But it's just so easy to have that anchor point and to have an anchoring bias. And, you know, the thing of it is, it happens to the best of us, and you don't know you have a bias. That's kind of the definition of a bias, isn't it?
I want to thank y'all for these podcasts that y'all did, because that put information out. Like, my phone number is one thing. Of course, I wasn't crazy about it, but putting out the email for people to report. And I got several people that had sent me things, you know, and I tried to run down everything that was asked of me on that. And because it didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
Y'all didn't have to go the extra step, but you did. And I think both of you, but I think the Texas County Gazette for their support of us and trying to bring this case to a resolve.
Now, this is something I just thought of. Vera Alexander lived with Weldon after the fact for a couple of years and then died by suicide. She was alone with him. Do y'all think y'all are ever going to look at that again?
That is something that the suicide occurred, or whatever it happened, was on Texas side, and they, you know, they're aware of everything that's going on in their lab. People, they'll look at it and make sure that it is suicide and not a homicide. But they're, like I said, they are very aware of this.
So, the two of you have become friends since this has started, obviously. What do y'all have planned next?
I am working for the Arkansas State Police as a cold case investigator, and I have other cold cases on my caseload that I'm currently working. Captain Seward and I have become good friends, and he and I have talked about some other cold cases there in that area, and we may end up working together on another one, or we may just send each other Christmas cards. What do you think, Calvin?
Yeah. As soon as I get all of the paperwork done on this, you know, there'll be a little time to need to really sit down and just think about. But there is some cases that need to be looked at, and the department has indicated that if I wish to do that, that they would let me or back me up or do whatever I want to do on it. And so that determination will be made probably by the first of the year anyway.
True Crime Texarkana is a Texarkana Gazette podcast created in Star Bear Studio, right here in downtown Texarkana, USA. Mallory Wyatt reported and wrote the show. Carl Richter produced, edited, and contributed vocals. Chris Finley composed the main theme music. To support the show, leave a 5-star review wherever you listen.